possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Human Kinetics Publishers Incorporated, Champaign; Devro TPAC, Danville; and Illinois Graphics Incorporated, Bloomington. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. In this portion of the program, we dip into the Afternoon Magazine archives and rebroadcast an interview from November of last year when we talked with Dolores Hayden, a Yale professor of architecture, urbanism, and American studies, and the author of Building Suburbia. This interview was first conducted on November 26th of last year, so we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Today on the program, from Levittown, New York, to Park Forest, Illinois, to Disney's Celebration, Florida. Why do our suburbs, malls, and highways look the way they do? We'll take a look at the development of suburbia and see where we may be headed. Our guest this afternoon is Dolores Hayden, a professor of architecture and urbanism and a professor of American studies at Yale. Dolores Hayden is the author of 5 books. Her latest is Building Suburbia, Green Fields and Urban Growth, 1820 to 2000. Professor Hayden describes her book as an extended essay for the general reader, written by an urban landscape historian who is also an architect, wife, mother, and suburban resident. She says it probes relationships between physical design, culture, and economic life that readers in the United States may never have questioned. Well, we're about to do that this afternoon. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments on suburbia for Professor Dolores Hayden. Join the discussion with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Dolores Hayden's book, Building Suburbia, Green Fields and Urban Growth, 1820 to 2000, is published by Pantheon. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Hayden, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, I'm very pleased to be with you today.
You know, I live in the city of Urbana, not far from the center of town. It's an older part of the city, yet it feels like a small town or suburb. And when I think of the suburb, I think of communities that ring big cities like Chicago. I think it would be useful here to start off with a definition of suburb. And is it interchangeable with housing development?
Well, that's a very good question, because many suburbs in the United States have emerged through the development of speculative one-family house tracts. And so one may imagine that that's the only kind of suburb that we know how to do in this country. But in my book, I decided that I would categorize 7 American suburbs as typical of our development from the early 19th century to the present. And they were all a little bit different.
Yeah. What are those 7 vernacular patterns?
Well, we started with borderlands outside of cities that were very, very small port cities, usually on the East Coast, places like New York and Boston. And the borderlands were frequently places where middle-class families might go and buy a farm and then turn that farm into a suburban house with a garden. The borderlands were pretty disorganized, but by about 1840, there were architects and landscape architects commissioned to design new suburban communities, frequently with shared open space, and those were called picturesque enclaves. They tended to emphasize trees and the provision of common green spaces that would be available to fairly affluent residents. And so we still have some picturesque enclaves being built today. Mm-hmm. But quickly they were imitated by speculators who built out along the transit lines coming out of cities after about 1860 or 1870, and those were called the streetcar build-outs. And so places like Cambridge and Somerville outside of Boston would be typical streetcar build-outs where there would be one and two and three family buildings, and sometimes there'd be mom-and-pop stores with apartments upstairs, small lots, but a great sense of family connectedness. Frequently, someone would build a house in a streetcar area and then invite the children or the elderly grandparents to move in. The three-generation family was pretty common.
Hmm.
And then, as those communities began also to have additional ones platted outside them, around 1900, there began to be mail-order and self-built suburbs, sometimes served by automobiles. But frequently the self-builders were short of money. They might be looking to buy a lot and then scavenge some building materials to do it themselves. And so there's a whole era from about 1900 to 1940 where many of the suburbs in this country are do-it-yourself projects.
Like the Sears houses.
Like the...
The mail-order houses. And
the mail-order houses.
Yeah.
Someone could call Sears, right? And get 40,000 pieces of lumber and hardware delivered to a site. It was pretty intimidating, I think, when it all arrived.
Yeah. Those houses look pretty good to me today, though.
Well, people sometimes did manage to finish them
yeah.
if they had construction skills or they hired local builders to help them out.
Yeah.
And often there was a tremendous sense of pride associated with finishing a self-built house.
Yeah. And then 1940, the war and post-war.
Well, by 1945, after World War II, the federal government had stepped in to regulate suburbs and to provide subsidies in the form of mortgage insurance for developers and tax deductions for white male homeowners. And so we began to get suburbs like Levittown outside of New York, Park Forest outside of Chicago, or Lakewood in California near Long Beach, between Los Angeles and Long Beach.
Yeah.
And those became heavily, heavily publicized. You couldn't open a newspaper or a magazine without reading about veterans taking their families to these new suburbs of small tract houses.
Yeah.
And today, when we think about them, I suppose we're surprised that the houses were frequently 800 square feet, pretty tiny, two
mm-hmm.
bedrooms. No garage, but people felt that they were acquiring a place to live, and that was the single most important thing after a long period of housing shortages.
Yeah, and those housing shortages went back to the early years of the war when we were mobilizing for war, when we were building goods for war.
Well, if you were a builder, you probably couldn't get building materials. You couldn't get lumber and nails, metal parts of the house during World War II. And then during the Depression, there'd been a real shutdown of building, too. So there'd been about a 15-year time when there were very few new houses built.
So a lot of pent-up demand.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And so almost anything would have sold in that post-war period. But what was particularly difficult about it was that there were really no requirements to build well or to build community infrastructure. So a place like Levittown, New York was created, and I think there were over 17,000 houses, but they didn't bother to put in any sewers. And so that caused tremendous problems later down the line. Now, Park Forest was a much better design. There were many well-known town planners involved in Park Forest, and that worked more effectively.
Yeah.
The second problem, though, was that the federal rules governing mortgage insurance precluded having people of color in the same tract as whites. And so there was an enormous segregation of families. And they also generally precluded female-headed families from getting mortgages. So if you happened to be a woman who headed a family without a husband, or you were a person of color, many of those post-war suburbs were not open to you. And this created a tremendous amount of inequality, and we're still trying to deal with the consequences of that.
Yeah. So then the 50s come along and the 60s, and suburbia continues to boom.
We tried to correct for the preponderance of houses without community facilities in those post-World War II suburbs. So the result was another government program that's not quite so well known that provided accelerated depreciation for commercial real estate. And this started in 54 and ran till 86, and it spurred the construction of shopping malls, fast food places, and all kinds of other income-producing real estate, generally located next to highways. And, of course, by 56, we had a highway building program that opened up a lot of new land outside of suburbs for this kind of construction. So there was a huge rush to what we would now call the edge city or edge nodes, places where people finally found jobs outside of downtowns. But the edge nodes took a lot of economic possibilities away from traditional downtowns. And people began to work in the edge nodes. Often they didn't want to live there because they were rather ugly, chaotic, unplanned places. And so the next thing that happened by the 80s is that people started to get in the car at 5 o'clock after working a full day in the edge nodes and then drive further out to what might be an area of farmland or perhaps an old small town in this kind of rural area. And those are called the rural fringes. And those are our fastest growing areas today. Those are the suburbs that are being made right now.
Yeah. So it seems that the issue, the problem of sprawl, was a long time in the making.
I think we'd have to say that at least since the 1860s or 1870s, there's been a great deal of unplanned growth, and it hasn't always been easy for people who were seeking housing, along with a connection to nature and some kind of community, to find ways to make these speculative communities work. So frequently people became volunteers. They would work to make houses in a subdivision into some kind of a real neighborhood and a real community. Lots of sweat equity, lots of nonprofit activity, lots of volunteers, trying to assure that the place eventually would have things such as good schools or public parks that the residents would tax themselves to provide.
When and how did Americans begin dreaming of a single-family home in a green landscape?
I think the dream has been there for a very long time. And if one goes back to the earliest settlements in New England, they were covenant communities where people signed the covenant to build a community. And frequently people thought of those as ideal communities that would be centered around a village green. And each family would have some kind of a dwelling, and then they would have some fields to farm, and everyone would gather on the village green, maybe in the church on Sunday. This is something that goes way back. For residents, the triple dream is shelter and a connection to nature and community. But for developers, I think the dream is different. For developers, the dream is to make a profit by having a place become dense and desirable. And so in many cases, the developers also want to avoid risk in creating new communities, and they like to have either the federal government or local government come in to provide as much infrastructure as possible. And so the dream of living in a place quietly is usually the resident's dream at odds with the developer's dream of making something that's booming and profitable.
Yeah, kind of like a bait-and-switch thing going on here.
Well, I think that it indicates that we have a problem in this country about thinking up front how to build well-balanced neighborhoods and how to build really solid towns. And if you think that way, then it seems you can put in the infrastructure at the beginning, you can build for the long term. But if things are very much in private hands and there's a lot of competition, then there tends to be a backing away from doing some of those more expensive upfront investments in town building and neighborhood building.
Yeah. The role religion and religious imagery played early on in suburban development is quite interesting. Would you tell us about that?
Well, I looked at the manuals that were bestsellers back in the 1840s or 1850s. They were guidebooks for people who were going out to the suburbs to create life on their own. And I was particularly taken with Catherine Beecher's manual, The American Woman's Home, which she co-wrote with her sister, Harriet Beecher Stowe, the novelist. And in it, Catherine Beecher really romanticized gender roles. The man was to be the breadwinner who went to the city every day and had to deal with the ups and downs of capitalism, the kind of boom and bust economy. The woman was supposed to be someone who stayed at home and removed herself from that kind of anxiety. The woman was supposed to be a self-sacrificing minister of the home, and Beecher actually described her particular design for a house as the Home Church of Jesus Christ. That was a very intensely Protestant pitch for female domesticity. And the woman was supposed to rear 10 children, a number that seems kind of impossible to us now. And also she was going to do her own housework without servants, which would be perhaps something that required some labor-saving design and special inventions. And Beecher tried to provide those. And the woman was also going to be called the home minister in the Church of Jesus Christ as a way of suggesting that she gets some reward in heaven for all this work on earth. And this was a very, very popular way of understanding 19th century suburban life for middle-class women at any rate, and Protestant women. But these ideas also spread to Catholic and Jewish women. And I think today they are reflected in certain kinds of campaigns for very traditional so-called family values, meaning the woman should be home, nurturing everyone else in the society, the men, the children, the elderly. It's a pretty old-fashioned definition of what gender roles would be. And, of course, today most women are in the paid labor force. But they still may be trying to handle these roles at home as well, because these things go on for a very long time as the accepted assumptions about what really should happen in a domestic landscape.
Mm. And Catherine Beecher, she did not marry, and she didn't. She
no,
had no
she
children.
She was a single woman who had a very public career as a lecturer, telling other women what to do.
What to do.
I think, in a way, she was sort of Martha Stewart of her time with these popular manuals about domestic science and housekeeping. But, in fact, she was a very public woman.
Yeah. She had some pretty good design ideas for homes, I thought, though.
Oh, she was tremendously clever. She was a self-taught architect, and she pioneered the single-surface workspace in the kitchen. She developed the house with indoor plumbing and heating and ventilation of a very high standard, which men hadn't bothered with before. She designed movable walls so that spaces like traditional Victorian parlors could be made more useful for different kinds of activities. She was up to date on everything connected with home design.
Very interesting. Dolores Hayden is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about suburbia. Her latest book is Building Suburbia, Green Fields and Urban Growth, 1820 to 2000. Dolores Hayden is a professor of architecture and urbanism and a professor of American studies at Yale. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments on suburbia. Give us a call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Building Suburbia, very fascinating reading, Professor Hayden. The connections between national politics and gender politics. We've talked about Catherine Beecher. Maybe it would be fun here to remember, or instructive anyway, to remember the kitchen debate.
Oh, well, in the period after World War II, the United States set out to build millions of single-family houses. And in that era, Americans used about three-quarters of the appliances and gadgets that were produced anywhere in the world. This was a very high consumption society. We believed that energy was cheap and that we could go on consuming electricity to run all kinds of appliances, air conditioning, and all kinds of gadgets in American houses. And at one point, Nixon was in Moscow for an exhibit which was highlighting the differences between the Soviet Union and the United States in the Cold War 50s. And Nixon pointed to things like toasters and refrigerators, and then finally to a model house which was called the Splitnik, which is a split-level house of an American design built in Moscow. And they had what was called the kitchen debate, where Nixon argued that a society that had so many model houses would inevitably win the Cold War. This, of course, wasn't as spontaneous as it sounded. Researchers have suggested that he had tipped off a number of public relations people and media people so that they actually just happened to catch him with Khrushchev, you know, in the kitchen of the model house. And then the debate occurred.
Yeah. At this time, the movies also were pretty informative about our ideas about home and where we lived, where that home was. You write about Mr. Blandings builds his dream house, and that movie was remade, I guess. I never saw The Money Pit, but it's the same idea. Have you seen The Money Pit?
No, I don't think that I have. Is it about construction of a house?
Yeah, and it's about this couple, and they buy this house, and their dream is to be out, you know, in the countryside, and it's one thing after another going wrong, and you know, one disaster with one part of the house after another. And I was just curious because I wonder, I'm going to have to rent that movie now and look at it and see, because I have seen Mr. Blandings builds his dream house, and I wonder how the two films are similar and how they are different, you know, 40 years apart or so.
Well, Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House was the story of an advertising man from New York who quits. He has a wife and two daughters, and they're very unhappy in a small apartment in the city. And so they buy an old house in Connecticut, hoping to live in it. And then they decide that it's actually a little bit too run down. So they tear down the old house and hire local builders to build them a new house in an old style. And Mr. Blandings has a lot of trouble with the construction. Finally, he spent about $50,000 or $55,000, and they get into the house. And that's the end of the movie. What happened was called a public relations man's dream because there were 70 Mr. Blandings lookalike houses built around the country by developers, and they all sold it for much less than Mr. Blandings paid in the movie. And people lined up for hours to go see these model houses and then maybe bid on them. At the same time, people all over the country were talking about the movie. So the movie sold the houses and the houses sold the movie. And this was a perfect example of cross-promotion. What people never learned was that the same author of Mr. Blandings, Eric Hodgins, wrote a sequel. And the sequel was never filmed. It was never heavily publicized. But in the sequel, Mr. Blandings got very tired of life in the suburbs and moved his family back to an apartment in New York City. And the appeal of Manhattan was triumphant.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Blandings, he was never comfortable out there in the countryside.
No, I think he was always a bit, you know, at odds with these various construction people who seemed to be taking advantage of him. And so there was another subtext to the movie, which is that traditional construction workers would take advantage of people and that they couldn't solve the housing crisis after World War II. And so it was used in a way to promote the Levitt approach to building, which was without unionized workers in particular trades. Levitt had his workers move down the street doing repetitive activities on house after house, and they were equipped with small power tools, and they were definitely a non-union, de-skilled labor force. It's a very complicated time when so many people want to make their political points around the provision of housing in the late 40s and through the 50s.
Well, that brings us to the 1947-48 housing hearings of Joseph McCarthy.
Well, yes. I had never known this before I started research on the book, but Joseph McCarthy began his red-baiting career with advocates of public housing, and long before he got to Hollywood or the State Department to claim that there were communists threatening the country's security, he was busy saying that anybody who was interested in building multifamily public housing after the war was going to be breeding communists in these neighborhoods. And so the public housing advocates had struggled for 10 or 15 years to put up some really wonderful demonstration projects, but they got a very bad name, and ultimately the legislation, the 1949 Housing Act, came through with so many restrictions on the possible cost of public housing units and the possible incomes of people who would live in those units that those projects were really stigmatized. And they were a very, very small proportion of the housing built in this country.
Yeah. Well, reading this in Building Suburbia was really an eye-opener. The contempt that some folks had for housing reformers, in particular women housing reformers.
That's right. That's right. The lobbyist for the National Association of Real Estate Builders claimed that suffrage was a bad idea for women, and that as soon as the women got the vote, he started having all kinds of problems with women reformers.
Yeah. This guy said, "I do not believe in democracy. I think it stinks."
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I don't think women should be allowed to vote at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were reactionary people who thought that the 100% of the housing market should belong to developers of single-family houses who were private developers. And they lobbied very hard to keep things that way.
Yeah. And to what extent do our housing policies today, you know, stem from the politics of this particular era?
Well, I think we haven't completely overcome the problems of the 50s. Most people in America today live in metropolitan regions that are composed of a central city, an old downtown, and then some edge nodes where there are jobs, and suburban areas stretching out for miles. And so we are still trying to figure out how to plan and organize these metropolitan regions. We're still trying to figure out how to provide affordable housing and access to open space. And many of our problems really do stem from the 50s and the 60s with the need to fix those old sitcom suburbs and edge cities to create more balanced neighborhoods and more livable places. But the United States today is a suburban nation. Most people do live in the suburbs. And so this is the problem that we all have to take on. How can we strengthen our neighborhoods, and how can we manage to conserve the best of the suburbs we have rather than constantly pushing out the edges of metro regions to build again while letting the older suburbs fall down?
Yeah. How do we feel about suburban cities today? Has somebody surveyed attitudes of Americans, those of us who are living in suburban areas today?
Some years ago, the Pew Charitable Trust asked people about what they thought were major problems, and sprawl was at the top of the list. The unplanned and uncoordinated use of land was right up at the top of the list. For white families. For black families, there were more worries about finding integrated neighborhoods, and that's also a legacy of the 50s in the sense that we still have frequently a split between affluent white outer suburbs and declining inner city suburbs and older suburbs, which may have a large number of people of color and people in poverty concentrated in them who are really there as a result of the policies of the 50s and the 60s.
Mm.
Even though we have fair housing legislation now and the credit situation is better, we still have to deal with the results of those earlier decades of segregation, and the consequences are still with us.
Mm. Let's talk with a couple of listeners now. First, we're going to go to a listener in Urbana. Line 1, hello.
Oh, hi. That was interesting about Levittown not having sewers. I've never heard that before. And you also mentioned how blacks were excluded because of the mortgage rules. My first question is, I was wondering if that was also true for Hispanics.
Yes.
Okay. And then the my big questions have to do with homeowners associations and gated communities. I don't know if you really get into that much, but I know I put my father into a homeowners association, and I warned him beforehand, but it was really the best deal out there, what he was looking for. And but they are a very prickly, it's a prickly situation, and I was just wondering if you could talk about them and maybe gated communities, too, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, there were a lot of Americans thinking about moving into what are called sometimes privatopias, that is, community of interest developments, where people join a homeowners association, which frequently functions as a private government. And the homeowners association may do things like may substitute for the local police, the trash pickup, and so forth. They come in all kinds of income categories. There are privatopias that are thought of as security zone communities, sometimes in inner city areas where people are fearful of crime. And there are also retirement communities and elite communities. Sometimes they have gates, not always. Sometimes they are places that have very rigid rules about the color you can paint your house, the color of your curtains. But there are many Americans who are choosing to live in these communities. And a really good book about them is Setha Lowe's book, Behind the Gates. She's an anthropologist who interviewed Americans in many different communities that were privatopias to see just how they explained their desire to live there. And you might find that a fascinating account. First-person testimonies from those communities.
Yeah. How do those communities today differ from the ones that were, oh, I don't know, would have been the mid-19th century, the enclave?
Well, something like Llewellyn Park was an early picturesque enclave, and it was a gated community with very lavish landscaping, common landscaping. I think the privatopias that descend from that today would be the elite communities that do have also sometimes amenities such as golf courses or country clubs. Mm. And we've had these since the 19th century as communities that try to provide a kind of instant social status.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line 2. Hi.
Hello. First a comment and then a question. You mentioned, Celeste, you asked earlier whether public housing was still carrying the burden of those attitudes from the 40s and 50s, and I would say definitely in this community in particular, much of our housing stock, public housing stock, is dated from those times. And if you look through the course of the last 50 years, HUD has consistently been underfunded and thrown back and forth by various politicians with other agendas. But anyway, let me get to my question. I'm spending a lot of time these days working to help improve neighborhoods, and I think one of the fundamental questions that we have to ask ourselves is, what does it mean to have a working or a fixed or a good or a neighborhood that we consider to be healthy? And I'd just like to hear you work that out for us a little bit. Thank you.
Well, it's certainly a great question, and I think in my personal sense, I would answer that by saying that neighborhood should have a balance of different kinds of housing units so that it could accommodate families with children, families without children, young people just starting out in perhaps small apartments, older retired people who are on fixed incomes and perhaps both the young people and the older people would be especially likely to need some kind of public transportation, so not everything would be revolving around a family owning two or three cars, which is the case in many isolated suburbs today. I think that good neighborhood would also have some mixed use in that it wouldn't be 100% residential. It would include some kinds of commercial space, so that one wouldn't need to drive 10 miles to buy a few groceries or get some milk. It would include some public open space, parks, perhaps certainly playgrounds for children, things that really are part of our ordinary American understanding about what makes a good neighborhood, but things that have disappeared as houses have grown larger, and today the average house is maybe 2,100 square feet, and as lots have grown larger, and as many subdivisions have developed as residential only. So I would say that we need to step back to the patterns that are typical of some of our older suburbs and small town centers, and many, many people are looking for that mix today.
Yeah. There's an interesting thing going on in a suburb that I've visited recently, Chicago suburb of Park Ridge. It's one of the older suburbs. And in this suburb, people are, I haven't talked to anyone who's doing this, but I have noticed that people will come into this older suburb and will knock down the smaller, older home and put a home twice the size or more on the same lot. Is this a trend in other older suburban cities, and can you offer us any insights into what's involved here?
I'm sorry to say it is a trend, and these are called teardowns.
Mm-hmm.
We used to think that teardowns would only be really dilapidated older houses, but starting in the 1990s, there began to be teardowns, certainly in the state of Connecticut. I've observed that 18th-century salt boxes that were historic landmarks became teardowns. Classic modern houses of the 1950s became teardowns. And just about everything else you can imagine. It's a very serious problem because the new building, which is the monster house that's three times larger than the older building, usually changes the whole feeling of the street, and it begins to make one building of enormous bulk that looms over all the other houses that were part of this desirable neighborhood. And so sometimes it sets off a chain reaction, and after you've had one tear down leading to a monster house, you might have half a dozen.
Yeah, and the cars that go along with the big house are another issue as well. You need a big garage and a driveway, and
well,
it really does affect the entire neighborhood.
I think that these teardowns really suggest the importance of preservation in traditional neighborhoods. Many need to be made historic districts of some kind, just simply to preserve the setbacks and the side lots and the sidewalks. And often people don't realize in a neighborhood that they like living in that there may be very large zoning envelopes on each site. For example, there might be a 7,000 square foot possible building envelope prescribed in your local zoning, even though most of the houses in your street were 1,500 square feet or something like that.
Mm.
And so when that's the case, it promotes the teardowns and monster houses because it's possible to go up to, you know, something three stories high and much, much wider than everything else around it. And the way to fix that is to anticipate that this could happen and try to get the zoning more in line with what people have now and would like to protect.
Yeah, I've got another listener waiting, and I want to get to this caller right away, but I do want to ask a follow-up question. Why is it that people are attracted to the older suburbs rather than moving to the edge node?
Oh, I think people like sidewalks, and I think they like houses that can permit a certain amount of neighboring. because there is a visual connection to the street and to other houses. I think people also like mature plantings,
mm-hmm.
and some people may prefer the architecture that would have been typical of earlier times to some of the things that are built now that are large but really very rough.
Let's talk with a listener waiting for us in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling with a question about what I hope is a trend in the other direction. I've read about a suburb of Denver, Colorado called Lakewood, where evidently they're in the process of actually tearing down a large mall area and rebuilding essentially a downtown for the suburb, where they're destroying what was a huge mall, taking it out and replacing it with what might be considered a really active downtown with shops and housing and the possibility of a more neighborly context. I'm interested in finding out if there are other examples of this happening around the country. I will hang up and listen to the answer. Thanks.
I think there are communities that are plagued by what we call dead malls because the United States built so many malls. We built twice as much retail space as any other country in the world with all of those subsidies for malls that went on for about 30 years. So now we're finding that we have what's called a mall glut, too many malls, and some of them are not succeeding. And so the answer to this that some communities have come up with is to take out the dead mall or rebuild it, and to rebuild it with mixed uses to include some housing. The other possibility where there are dead malls is to look for more nonprofit uses. For example, to reuse those dead malls as community colleges, or to find ways to turn them into perhaps child care centers, playgrounds, things that the community's needed for a long time. And that's another way to go with the dead mall problem.
Yeah. A friend of mine grew up in the suburb of Park Forest.
Yes.
And I was talking with him this morning, and we were wondering how old suburban cities are faring in general, and he said that Park Forest's housing stock is in pretty good shape now, but the downtown has struggled. It was once a shopping center.
Mm-hmm.
What is key to keeping a suburban city thriving? In Park Forest's case, apparently the edge node is Madison, Illinois, Mattison. Anyway, what is key to keeping a suburban city thriving? That's a pretty nice place to live.
Well, I think that we've got this problem all over the country. In older suburbs, there are frequently small businesses of different kinds that have been established for a long time. You know, in my town, there's an 8-acre village green, and it's surrounded by a lot of small stores, including a hardware store, bookstore, small grocery store, small stationery store, for example. And what threatens the vitality of places like this is usually the arrival of big box discount stores that come to the edge node. And big box discount stores are frequently often undercutting older and closed malls, and that's part of the reason they're dead malls. And they're also undercutting a lot of small businesses. So when somebody studied Iowa, for example, in a 10-year period, they discovered over 7,000 small businesses in small towns gave way with the arrival of big box stores.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answer to this is to think very hard about the practices of the big box stores. And certain chains of big box stores tend not to pay their employees very well. We've seen a lot of front page stories lately about that. And frequently they are trying to drive prices down to a very low level when they open the store in order to win out over the small businesses around them. And then once they have no competition, the prices may go back up again. It's a very, very tough kind of marketing. Sometimes this is called cannibalizing the opposition. It seems to me people have to think in each community about whether or not they will really just patronize big box stores. And as consumers, we all do have the possibility of buying things in one place or another. So I don't think we should take it for granted that it's always wise to buy in the cheapest place.
Let's squeeze our last caller in here this afternoon before we have to wrap things up. But we'll have to be quick. We have a caller waiting for us in Chicago. Line 4, go ahead.
As an adjunct to the problem of suburban sprawl, I think the glut of and bottleneck of transportation arteries causes us to realize we have to have more public transportation to sort of relieve the strain on this flow and pollution-adding and energy-consuming individual automobile traffic that's been going on. So I think transportation has got to be an integral part of any further suburban development. Thank you.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. The United States has over 137 million automobiles, and with our interstate highway program, we really favored cars and trucks over any kind of public transportation. And in order to get more balanced neighborhoods back, we have to turn that around.
That's where we have to leave it. We've used up the time. Dolores Hayden, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, it was really a pleasure being on your show. Thank you so much for having me.
Dolores Hayden, look for her book, Building Suburbia, Greenfields and Urban Growth, 1820 to 2000. It's written for the general reader. It is published by Pantheon Books. And that interview conducted on November 26th of last year. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, wheat under pressure from harvest. The corn under pressure today as the crop progress reports released Monday afternoon showed the conditions were fairly stable across the Midwest. In fact, stable if you look at the good to excellent conditions of the corn. But if you divide those out, good and excellent, the corn got a little better than it was last week in most states. I thought nationally it was up 2% in the excellent category. So that number pushed the market down just a bit in the corn pit. In fact, into the realm of a gap left way back on January the 12th. That's the day that a crop production, the final crop production report from last year came out, and it pushed the market up sharply higher that day, started a big run up in the market, and she's back down into that gap area today, though it did not fill it completely. So let's begin. July wheat futures, high 351 today. Low at 343, and a settlement price there at 343.75. That July contract in the wheat pit down 10.5 cents. September futures, 360, the high, the low at 352. Settlement price at 352.75, down 10.5. And the December contract, 371, the high, the low at 362. A settlement price there at 363.5, down 10.25. March contract, 377, the high, the low at 372. Settled 372.5, down 9.5 cents. And the May contract, 376, the high, the low, and settlement price both at 374 for the May wheat, down 8.5 cents. From the corn pit now, July corn, 274.5, the high, the low at 266.5. The gap started, by the way, on the top side at 267.5, so it dipped a penny into it. A settlement price just above that gap at 267.75, down 6.75 in the July corn. The gap, of course, from January the 12th. September corn now, 278.5, the high, the low at 271.75. Settled 272.5, down 6.5 in December contract. 281.75, the high, the low at 276.5. A settlement price there at 277.25. I believe that's the lowest since February the 2nd, down 5 cents for the day. March contract, 287, the high, the low at 282.5. A settlement price at 283.5, down 4. And the May corn, 291.75, the high, the low at 287.5. Settled 288.25, down 4.5 cents for the day. July contract in the corn pit, 293.25, high, low at 289.25. Settled on that low, down 4.5 cents. In the September futures, 280, the high, the low at 278.5, settled 280, down 1.5. December corn, 269.5, the high, the low at 268.25, and a settlement price there at 268.5, down a penny and a half. July oats, 144.5, the high, the low at 141.25, and a settlement price at 142.75, down 0.5 cents. September oats, 151, the high, the low at 146.5, and settled at 147.5. They were down a penny and 3/4 for the day. From the soy complex, soybeans off a penny and a half for the day, 898 in the July contract for the high, the low at 881, settlement price at 887, once again 1.5 cents lower. August beans down 2, 825.5, the high, the low at 813.5, settlement price at 815.5, they were down 2. September futures, 724. The high, the low at 710. Settled 713, 3.5 lower. And the November, 684. The high, the low at 668. Settlement price at 671.75, down 7.25. January soybeans, 684. The high, the low at 671. Settled 673.5, down 6.5 cents. And the March futures, 679. The high, the low at 669. Settled 672, down 6. In the May contract, 672.5 high, low at 662, settled 664, down a nickel for the day. July bean meal, 297, the high, the low at 289.30, settlement price at 296.20. The meal, the only place on the across the board in the ag futures that managed a gainer today, up 320. August contract, 279, the high, the low at 271.50, settled 277.20. They were up 230 for the day. July bean oil, 28.66, the high, the low at 28.19, settlement price at 28.27. Oh, the oil was up 2, up 4. August contract, 27.78, the high, the low at 27.29, settlement price at 27.36, and they were down 5 on the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. August feeder cattle, today's high 111.95, the low 111 even, the settlement 111.62.5, that up 60. September, 109.80, the high 108.60, the low 109.80, the settlement, that up 80. October, 108.20 the high, 107.17.5 the low, the settlement 107.82.5, that up 32.5. June live cattle, 87.50 the high, 86.45 the low, 86.65 the settlement, that down 35. August live cattle, 88.25 the high, 86.65 the low, the settlement 87.12.5, that down 25. July lean hog, 78.40 the high, 76.70 the low, 77.02.5 the settlement, that down 87.5. August lean hog, 76.90 the high, 75.20 the low, 75.40 the settlement, that down 92.5. October lean hog, 65.90 the high, 64.50 the low, 64.90 the settlement, that down 57.5. December lean hog, 60.85 the high, 59.60 the low, 59.95 the settlement. That down 52.5. July bellies, 116.50 the high, the low 114.90, the settlement 115.45, that up 52.5. The Dow up 18 points at 10,389. The NASDAQ is up 16 points at 1991. The S&P 500 up 4 points at 1134.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau, whose mission is to improve the economic well-being of agriculture and enrich the quality of farm family life.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Oliver Boudreau from Baton Rouge, Louisiana writes, Dear Dr. Science, what does BOD mean?
It's a corruption of the French patois for bad, meaning inferior or evil. Indeed, much of Louisiana can be described as a bawd place, running at a very low transfer rate, sometimes as slow as 2 bites per second. My car once broke down somewhere along the Gulf.